Hello everyone, and welcome to the Reading Party podcast with Megan and Lexi. Together, we'll watch, snack, and chat our way through books and films set in the ancient world. We bring our expertise as ancient historians to the table to dissect every detail. We hope you'll grab your favourite beverage and snacks and join us every week on this adventure. Before we start spilling the tea, a brief note on our content. The Reading Party podcast is created for adult audiences. The stories of the ancient world are full of violence and undisguised sexual content, and your hosts aren't afraid to curse up a storm. For those reasons, this podcast is not suitable for under 18s, and certain episodes may not be suitable for those living with trauma. This season, we're focusing on stories set in ancient Egypt, and we'll be bringing in guest hosts that are subject matter experts to help us really dig into the history of what we're reading and watching. With that in mind, let's get going. Lexi and I have our teas and are so ready to start spilling the tea on a ton of ancient stories. Hello. I actually forgot to get a cup of tea before we started recording. The week has been, we were talking about this earlier, the week has been a little bit insane. So I haven't actually sat down since I woke up. So I've had a cup of tea, but then I came home and immediately went into clearing the house, trying to restore some kind of order. And I didn't stop until actually 2 minutes after we were supposed to start recording. So I don't have tea today.
Okay, it's okay.
But what are you drinking?
It is a green tea with mint.
Ooh, very nice.
So it smells very minty and delicious. And
very nice.
The reason I have this today is because I finished our green tea with peach and mango and I'm very sad and I need to order more. So this is the backup.
I need to try some green tea with peach and mango because that sounds really,
it's
really tasty.
It's so good. It's very conducive.
We've talked about the joys of mango tea before.
We have. I mean, still the best tea ever, mango black tea, and the company that makes it went out of business or doesn't ship it or whatever. So now I can't get my mango black and I'm very upset about it.
No.
Yeah, very sad.
That's not good.
Yeah.
That's not good.
Anyway.
Well, today we are talking about the 1963 movie Cleopatra with Elizabeth Taylor, which I think is the first thing to popularize the whole Cleopatra with big bright blue eyeshadow look, which is now a staple of Halloween in the Western world. And I'd not actually seen this film before. It's
insane.
Nearly 4 hours long.
True. It's long.
Yes. It is very long.
Yeah.
And yeah.
People don't have attention spans like that anymore.
No, I'm not very good at watching films anyway. I have to, if I'm sitting down and watching something, I have to have something to do with my hands. Mm. So I'm knitting or sewing or doing something. And I don't usually have 4 hours at a stretch just to sit.
Well, with children, yes. I mean, finding an hour is probably hard, much less four.
It can be.
But, you know, yeah, I get it, though, because I have ADD. And so I would like to say productively that I do something with my hands, but I don't. Sometimes I'll knit, but most often you can find me playing solitaire on my phone, which my mom never believes that I can concentrate because she's like, but you're concentrating on a... And I'm like, Mom, I have played solitaire so many times and I'm such a pro at it. It's literally a mindless exercise. Like, I don't need a brain for this.
Yeah.
And she's like, I don't understand how you can have two screens. But I'm like, I don't know how to explain it. But anyone with ADD or whatever will know.
I concentrate better, I find, if I've got part of my brain occupied with something else.
Yeah. It's a weird thing, right?
Very.
I'm so ADD that like one thing is hard. And unless it's something that I actively work, like sitting and passively doing something is hard. So I need two things at once, which...
I need a thing. I used to draw during high school classes. I'd sit with just my binder and draw and sketch while I listened to my teachers.
I was a class doodler, and I remember my math teacher was this interesting guy. I know this is kind of off topic, but I think it's funny anyway. So I'll relate it back, but I would draw a lot of ancient world and like mythology themed things. And so obviously when I was in like my big Yu-Gi-Oh phase, the whole thing, as I've mentioned to you many times, is all classical and Egyptian reception. And so I would routinely in like math class when I was super bored, I would sketch the big Egyptian themed monster. So I'd draw like an Anubis thing, and then I'd draw the winged dragon of Ra and all these Egyptian things. And then my math teacher would come, he would like walk around the classroom and kind of look down over your shoulder at what you were doing as he was talking, which was a weird thing for a teacher to do, especially in math class when I'm like, shouldn't you be at the board like drawing shit? But then he would see my drawings and then he would get super pissed and make me either put them away, or once he got so mad because it was like the fifth or sixth day in a row. So he took my paper, crumpled it up and threw it in the trash.
That's so mean.
Yeah, he was mean, but I'm not scarred, I don't think. Sort of. Anyway, but yeah, so the lesson there is Lexi would doodle Egyptian themed things in high school because she was bored and couldn't concentrate.
Yeah, that tracks. Absolutely. Definitely.
Yep.
We should do our summary.
We should recap this thing. So I know it's a long movie, so I thought maybe instead of having you do all of it, we could split it into halves. Do you want to recap like the first half and I can do the last, or vice versa?
Yes, I can do the first half.
Nice. Okay, go ahead.
That sounds good. Yeah. So we open with Julius Caesar looking regal and majestic on a boat. Just arrived at Egypt and it's market day for unknown reasons. And everyone's really pissed that it's market day because they're like, how are we supposed to get to the Pharaoh? Like, we're going to just like clear away with all our big armed men? And Caesar says, no, we will shop. We will shop our way to Pharaoh, which was honestly my favorite line. It's not the line he said, I'm paraphrasing, but it was my favorite line in the entire film. I think it worked very, very nicely. So they shop their way through the marketplace until they get to Pharaoh. And the whole story for the first part is Cleopatra obviously trying to reclaim her throne. And you're told in the beginning that Cleopatra's dead. She's not dead. And that Ptolemy is there and he's the real pharaoh and he has these advisors. And one of them is for some reason wearing baby blue and pale pink robes. We talked about this before because he's a eunuch. So obviously not having testicles means he has to be dressed in baby blue and light pink, neither of which I believe are colors that would have been very common in the ancient world. Probably not the pink, maybe the blue. Who knows? It was an interesting ensemble. Very interesting. So Caesar's there. He kind of takes over. Cleopatra gets carried into his quarters in a rug, which I think is a story that a lot of people are vaguely familiar with. I'd heard it before. I wasn't sure where it came from. Here we go. Cleopatra comes in a rug. There's a very bizarre part where Caesar is asking the guy carrying the rug, why are you carrying the rug like that? And you have to turn the rug over so I can see the back of the rug. And I kind of get the impression that he knew there was someone in the rug. It was an interesting scene. And Cleopatra tumbles out and does this whole like rolling around the floor thing. Very amusing. And she proceeds to spend several scenes trying to seduce him and spying on him and trying to persuade him that actually she should get her own way. And he's all like, no, 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 no. You are a child. Do not bother me, child. And I, oh my God, really?
Okay, she's as much a child as frickin' whatever her name is who played Helen in...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
In the Helen of Troy movie.
Yes.
So he's very patronizing and very annoying, and somehow they fall in love. I don't know if she was supposed to be seducing him. I don't know if she actually loved him, but throughout the whole movie, she's like kind of obsessed with him a little bit. It's, yes, very strange, very interesting. So Caesar ultimately says that actually, yes, Cleopatra should be the ruler of Egypt. He kills or has the chief eunuch sentenced to death because they tried to poison Cleopatra. And then he sends Ptolemy and the other advisors off to join Ptolemy's army. And it's not Ptolemy's army. It's one of the other Roman armies. There are lots of Roman armies in this. I honestly got a bit confused about who was on whose side and what army was the army we were supposed to be rooting for. Lots of armies. So they send Ptolemy and his advisors off to join the bad Roman army. And Ptolemy says, yes, we will survive. And his advisor looks at him like he's a fucking moron and says, essentially, no, we won't, because our army is going to get destroyed. So we are all going to be killed. you're an idiot. And that's exactly what happens. Cleopatra is crowned queen of all of Egypt. It's very, very exciting. And then she marries Julius Caesar. Apparently it's not a problem that he's already married to a Roman woman. The Romans aren't very fond of this. There's various shots of senators in Rome talking about what's going on. And they're like, why is he marrying an Egyptian? Like, his marriage to this Egyptian woman is not sanctioned by Rome. It's not legal under Roman law. He has a wife. Cleopatra and Julius Caesar don't really seem to mind that he's already married to someone who seems like she's doing her best. So yes, that was interesting. They have a son together called Caesarion, who seems like a nice enough kid. I'm sure he's lovely. And then Caesar is recalled to Rome. So he goes back. And then after several years, he sends for Cleopatra. Again, not sure if she's supposed to go and like live in Rome long term, or if she's there for a diplomatic visit, or really what the hell's going on, because she appears to be living in the house with Caesar and his wife. That was not made explicit to me. Maybe I missed something. I don't know what was going on there. But she enters Rome, and entering Rome is this huge, it's a massive spectacle. Massive spectacle. She's pulled, there's a whole dance troupe that precedes her, full of lots of very, it would not be a movie or not be a sequence that gets made today. There are lots of tribal dances and there's half naked people of various ethnicities, and it was, yes, interesting watching. And then Cleopatra is pulled in on this ginormous gold statue, and she's sitting at the statue barely clears the processional archway that they go through, and she's decked out in a gold tiered dress with a massive headdress thing, and her son is next to her, and it looks very, very fancy. It looks really, really cool. It's very impressive. And everyone is really, really pleased to see her. The Roman populace love her. Not sure why. Probably because Egypt has all the gold and all of the grain that everyone will need ever. There's a big deal made of that throughout the whole movie. Lots of gold and grain, and everyone needs Egypt to like them, which is kind of why Cleopatra, I think, gets away with as much as she does. So yes, that was, again, interesting. And then she just hangs out in Rome for a while. Why? Who knows? Great question. Not entirely sure. She does at one point, I think, try and persuade Julius Caesar that... No, she doesn't try and persuade him to go back to Egypt. She's, through the course of the movie, trying to persuade him that he should essentially take over the whole entire world, which is interesting. Like, she's modeling him after Alexander the Great. You should do everything Alexander did. And Julius is like, oh, I'm an old man, and Alexander achieved all of this by the age of 30. And she said, well, essentially, it's not too late. We can still rule the world together. The two of us. It will be romantic. So he is apparently fully on board with this and gives it a very good try and is elected dictator, crowned dictator. I'm not sure what
elected
terminology is there. Elected dictator, thank you. And everyone is very, very happy that he is dictator. He is very upset, and Cleopatra is very upset to discover that actually this is more a ceremonial role than anything that holds any real power. And she pushes for him to be king, and various other people push for him to be king. And then right before he is, in fact, crowned king or given a kingship, they find out that he's not going to be given a true kingship of Rome. He will rule everything except Italy, which still seems like a pretty good deal for me. I mean, maybe I'm a barbaric picked from Britain living in a cave, but I feel like ruling the whole Roman Empire except the Italian peninsula, you know, that's pretty decent. That's a fair amount of power. But no, that is not okay. Caesar is very upset. Cleopatra is somewhat upset, but it doesn't happen anyway because he gets murdered on his way to the Senate, which is a tragedy, obviously. And Cleopatra leaves, goes back to Rome. There's a touching scene with Mark Anthony, who tries to persuade her to stay and he will take care of her. And she's like, no, what am I? I'm going to stay here for my son to be murdered by the people who just murdered my husband and his father? I don't think so. No, thank you. So she gets on a boat and fucks off. And then the movie cuts to 4 years later and she's in Egypt. And Mark Anthony is
I don't think they set, because we just had intermission.
They say at some point, yeah, so there's the intermission. And after this bit, I'll be quiet and let you take over, Lexi. There's the intermission, but both of them, Cleopatra and Mark Antony, say at a couple of different points, it's been 3 years and I have heard nothing, or something along those lines. So it's been several years. And you open with Cleopatra back in Egypt, and Mark Antony, we are told where he is. I can't remember where he is. He's around the Mediterranean somewhere. He's not in Rome. But they're both essentially pissed off that the other one hasn't sent some kind of message. So they've been doing this weird, he has to message me first, and she has to message me first, and I'm not texting first. Lose the upper hand if you do that. Yeah, so that's where we pick up again with Lexi.
Yeah, well, okay, that was an action-packed first half. Like, a lot went down there. Yeah, so essentially, when we do pick up after the intermission, and they do go through this, where is Cleopatra? Because it's not immediately presented to us where she is, because we pick up with Mark Antony. But essentially, I had to reference the history books to make sure I was piecing this correctly. So in looking back, so this would have been when Antony was planning his campaign against Parthia in the east. So I did remember that a large part of it was that Antony was like stubborn and didn't want to be seen as begging anybody for resources, but we all know he didn't have the resources. So essentially Cleopatra said, well, I'm a goddess, so you suppliants will come and beg me. And her only condition, and I remember this from class that I learned it in, her only condition was, you have to come to Egyptian soil. I will not bend to Rome. Now, it was advantageous to her to team up with another rich Roman. So like, she actually needed him, but to essentially just, it was all a brilliant PR stunt. So essentially the scene you get when she sails her barge up to meet him, this is the famous meeting in Tarsus that we learn about. And so essentially she gets to have her PR win and say, you will come to Egypt, because as she says, I am Egypt. So wherever she is, it's essentially Egypt. So by having him walk onto her ship, it's still Egyptian soil. So that's in Egypt. So yes, they essentially have this meeting, and then she throws this dinner, and she essentially makes fun of Mark Antony and his sort of desire for her. So they stage this like pageant. They have all these like scantily clad dancers dancing around him. And then they have a representation of Antony and an actress playing Cleopatra, fooling around, kissing on this weird spinning dais thing. It's really bizarre. So he gets all jealous and then like essentially makes a scene and like launches himself, let's say, as fast as possible out of his chair and goes and like makes a show of like ripping the actor out of actress Cleopatra's arms and like kisses her. And the real Cleopatra, to his dismay, has like disappeared. So he gets all pissy and then he goes and finds her where she's like apparently trying to sleep. And then
she's just in bed.
Yeah, she's just,
well, there's this banquet going on.
She's just like lying in bed, and then he's all pissy, and then just like does the creepy boyfriend thing where you like walk up to the edge of the bed and you stare at the woman, and then you just demand things. I think my favorite part of that was the whole, I need to know that if you're going to be my lover, I need to confirm some things. Also, do you sleep with the commemorative coins of your former lover, Caesar? To which she like sits up and is wearing this massive necklace, all of coins of Julius Caesar. And like any Roman man, person, dude, who's very jealous, he like rips it off of her. And then they proceed to have sex. And you're like, okay, that was a lot. Cool. But anyway, so essentially they're like living together and he's in Egypt. And then you see a grown-up Octavian being like, where's Antony? He's so popular. I need to start my scheme of showing how we love him, but also he's gone and I want to take over. And so you essentially, I don't know how much time passes, but essentially you see a messenger come and say, hey, Antony, your triumvirate failed because Octavian has kicked Lepidus out and you need to like go back and tie up some loose ends. To which he's like, I don't want to go, but like, fine, sure, I'll go. And then Cleopatra clearly is like, I don't want you to go, but fine, you can go. You should probably handle this because we can't let Octavian usurp your power. So he's all like, okay, fine, I'll go. To which then he gets back, and then surprise, Octavian had been plotting to marry his sister Octavia to Antony as a political convenience thing and to sort of keep him away from Cleopatra. To which he was like, okay, sure, I can't refuse. So he marries her, and then you get this dramatic scene of Cleopatra getting the news, and then she like takes a sword and like stabs through her bedding, his clothes and everything, and is screaming and having a meltdown. And you're like, this is fantastic. And then again, some time passes and he needs Cleopatra's money once again because of war and shit. And then he essentially doesn't want to, but he goes back and then they reconcile. And then he just stays in Egypt. And then everyone's like, see what a turncoat he is. And then, you know, war starts. And then Octavian's like, well, he is under the spell of this horrible witch. And so then you kind of just, it skips us along. And then suddenly here we are in 31 BC at the famous Battle of Actium, which if you're a classicist, you know that date rather well. But essentially they do kind of a great job at portraying this battle and what happens, because essentially he charges and then there's like a rumor that starts and then they're like, Antony is dead. And then Cleopatra's like, well, fuck, I'm leaving. Goodbye. And so she flees. And then Antony is, shocker, not dead, but he sees her like fleeing and then abandons his entire fleet to chase after her. And then they run away in shame. And his army is destroyed and everyone knows he's a coward and is now suckling at her teat, apparently, because they're like, she's the mother. She's controlling you. And now it's further proof that you must be handled. And so then we get to the end of the movie, essentially, where Octavian closes in and Cleopatra sends her son Caesarion in disguise out of Alexandria to try to hide him because they know that Octavian is coming for them. And she also, I mean, and in this time, Antony kind of went into like a depressive cycle where he would just like sort of sit in the darkness and be like, I have failed. I don't want to talk to anyone. I won't talk to you. And he's classic, sad, depressed man child. So then you're like, okay, that tracks. But eventually she does convince him to take a stand. And then he's like, okay, I'll fight one more battle. And then he essentially takes his like two legions against Octavian's like 30. And then they desert him in the middle of the night. And then he tries to go and force them to fight and kill him. And then they don't. So then he flees back to Alexandria and is ashamed. And then believing that Cleopatra's dead when she's hiding in her tomb. But it's not specified, because when he's like, Apollodorus, where is my love? And he's like, she's waiting for you in her tomb, and doesn't say whether she's dead or alive, which I was like, misdirect. Yeah. So then he kills himself because he's like, she's dead. And then he's like, oh shit, she's alive. And he's like, what? So then they like hoist his like dying body into her tomb, which amazing how they got that there. And then he dies in her arms. And then you're like, oh great. So then Octavian comes, and kind of off screen, you see that Octavian has captured and killed Caesarion. And so then he marches into the tomb and finds her and essentially is like making false promises, saying, I will let you rule Egypt still if you just submit to Rome's overall control. Don't harm yourself because I want to bring you back to Rome. And she was like, okay, fine, but I need a promise. And so he's like, okay. And she's like, okay, swear on the life of my son. And he's like, done. And she's like, great. So then I'll swear on it too, knowing that he's dead. But of course, Octavian doesn't know this. So the promise means nothing. So then he, for some inexplicable reason, leaves and is like, okay, I'll leave you to your own devices. To which she famously tells her handmaidens, I will not go. I know he's lying. Bring me my snake, my viper, and then help me eat some food and prepare me for my journey. And then Octavian comes back several hours later when it is dark. And then you see her elaborately draped already in her tomb with her ceremonial regalia, with the crook and flail and the thing. And then he gets really pissed off and like screams because he's so mad that he finds her and her handmaids, well, two of them are dead. And then one of them is alive, just to be like, yeah, fuck you. She did this out of spite. Goodbye. I'm dead. I'm out. And then dies. Then you just see him like rage. And then he leaves. And then camera pans out and they're like, dun, dun, dun. And so she's dead. End of movie. With a big outro musical thing. Yeah. So, and then you see like the snake wiggling away. Yeah, that was a lot, because it was like 4.5 hours of movie. But I love how they did include a lot of historical things. So if, even though like there was a lot that's inaccurate, because no one will accuse this movie of being accurate, but they put in a lot more than I thought they would. Like when, as I said, like the battles, I'm not a military historian, but I've always been fascinated by them. And so it was really cool that, like, again, you open the movie and you see, I think it's the battle of, I want to say it's Pharsalus in 48 BC. And then you have Actium in there. You have the armies of like Mithridates coming in at some point when you have Ptolemy fighting Mithridates' army. And then you see the burning of the Library of Cleopatra, which like, that's kind of an obscure fact. Like we all know the big date when we were like, oh, the library is burned down. And I find it interesting how we don't acknowledge or talk about in pop culture how half the library was severely burned in Julius Caesar's ploy in Alexandria during this conflict. And so the fact that we see it, we hear it, and they acknowledge and make a big deal out of it, I was like, this is really cool. Yeah, we get a lot. Okay, what was your favorite part of all of it?
I really enjoyed the characterization of Mark Antony as this whining, jealous, really petty person, actually. Yeah, he was, before Caesar dies, he's held up as like Caesar's right-hand man, and they have a really close relationship, and it's all great and wonderful. And then Caesar dies, and the second half of the movie, it's just Mark Antony shouting his insecurities from the literal rooftops. He's apparently been in love with Cleopatra since he first saw her and was very jealous of Julius Caesar for all kinds of reasons, but mainly jealous because of Cleopatra. And he does the whole necklace ripping off thing, which is very interesting. And the whole rest of it is just him feeling that he has to live up to this standard that Julius Caesar has set and being completely unable to do so. It was really, really, it was very well done. And I enjoyed Cleopatra as a person. I was less than thrilled with the whole seductress thing, but that's, I was kind of expecting that going in, to be honest. And we're going to be talking to Dr. Karakuni about this hopefully next week. And one of the questions I want to ask her actually is, what do we know about Cleopatra and her power, and how much of it was actually rooted in her sexuality, and how much of this idea is an invention of modern media? But that was, it was fascinating. And watching her kind of handle these Roman men, and they think that they're leading most of the time, but actually she's always there in the background, kind of nudging them toward where she wants them to go. That was very, very interesting. I enjoyed that. And the costuming was just fantastic. It was spectacular.
Very inaccurate, but spectacular. Yes.
Hugely, hugely inaccurate, but spectacular. What were some of your favorite parts?
Well, I think to the surprise of nobody, this is where I admit that this is not the first time I've seen it. I have seen this. I love it so much that honestly, like, this is the movie that I honestly put on as background noise. If I'm like, I'm trying to go to sleep, it's like downloaded onto my computer. It's the one I'll put on if I'm like on a plane and just need distraction. Yeah, despite all of its flaws and things. Yeah, it's one of the adaptations I love most. And so I always find something new going through, but I think the more I've seen it, and this is probably my 10th time, if not more, I love this version of Julius Caesar. You see so many adaptations with different versions of Caesar that I feel like we built up an idea of kind of what this man is supposed to be like. And I don't know if it was just a byproduct of Rex Harrison being cast as the older gent, but I like it because they made him seem a bit more like, even when he kind of went crazy and was like demanding all this power, it was always rooted in, he's like a deeply thoughtful Caesar. He is slow and methodical. He is not the fiery man who just like is a strumpet going around that I think some people think he was, just this hot-headed dude. And again, if you're playing a younger Caesar, like the one who's captured by pirates, maybe you have a younger, more Mark Antony like dude. But this one, just because of his age, I think he played it sort of understated, sort of low key. So there's something about Rex Harrison's performance that I really like. And I can't even like really describe it, other than it's just something innate that he did with the performance. And it balanced well against this Antony's sort of strumpet-like presentation. So every time I watch, I definitely am like, God, I could not love Rex Harrison's performance more. And actually, I find myself like having watched this movie so many different times, I find myself only wanting to watch the first half with Caesar. And then once he's killed, I'm kind of like, I don't need to see the rest.
Yeah.
I just really want to see like his interaction with her. And the other thing is like, I think I really appreciate it because pop culture sexualizes her and really turns her into this temptress, right? This Jezebel type woman. And I know Kara talks about this in her book, and hopefully we can get her talking about it next week. But from everything I've read and watched, she's not described as a very particularly beautiful person. It was her intellect. Like, she was the quintessential girl next door who's not pretty, but she's smart. And I mean, this is a woman who knew how many languages fluently, like 7 languages fluently. And she was involved in like political affairs and she knew the things. So from the history books and from what I remember in class, her relationship with Caesar was all intellectual. It was like a meeting of true minds where their intellects were soulmates. The physical part just kind of came along with it. I do want to know from Kara, like, was she actually, even though they were like, she's not the prettiest, I was like, well, I do want to know, was she pretty enough that she could still get away with her sexuality? Because I find it hard to believe that like a woman who would be described as kind of like straight up ugly would be able to accomplish this no matter how smart she is. So there was a degree of sexuality there. But so I think that like, even though they cast Elizabeth Taylor, who at the time was known in Hollywood as like the most beautiful woman in the world, the film gives us sort of a visual presentation that I don't think was accurate at all. But the fact that Rex Harrison played it intellectually and she seemed to match his energy, that was a kernel of truth there. And I really love that. And I love it every time I see it even more. I'm getting so philosophical. I don't know why. So yeah, I love that aspect the most, I think. But then I would say the other thing that I really, really loved about this one as well is not a lot of adaptations. They do, but they don't. It's weird. So they don't talk about her child situation, because if anything, you'll mention Caesarion maybe, and then that's kind of like a loose string that no one does anything with. And so again, you can't devote a lot of time to him. But instead of just being like, she has a son with Caesar, and then showing him once when he's dead, I did like how they did bring him to Rome, and then they did have this thing where like Caesar actually interacts with his son beyond just what you are maybe imagining. You have this adorable scene, and it is one of my favorites actually, that you have him teaching Caesarion how to be a ruler, kind of. So you have them in like identical purple robes, and he has like a little scepter, and it's adorable because you just have Rex Harrison sitting next to this little boy being like, and now this is how we interact with people. We sit and we glare and we don't smile because we need to have people fear you. And he's like, and this is how you pardon them. And he's like, yes, boy, sit up straight, point the scepter and go, I pardon you. And you have the little kid being like, I pardon you. And he's like, no, boy, that's not right. Here's how you do it. Be firm. And just, I love it because, yeah, you hear so much about Caesar and Cleopatra and Caesar's political things, but you never hear of him as a father, which, I mean, I guess maybe it's not that important. It's a footnote in history because what we have is what Octavian wants, but Octavian was not his direct son, even though he's technically his heir. So it's just interesting to see. And I liked the sort of extrapolation and the window into what we think Caesar would be like as an intellectual father. And it's quite clear that other than his lust for more power, he's emotional, but to a point where for him, it's all very practical. And what you see is like his love for Cleopatra and his son, it's all kind of conditional to the circumstances. It's not this all-encompassing fiery passion that Antony clearly had where it was like, I will sacrifice the world, watch it burn for you. It was always, I love you because you gave me my son, because I didn't have an heir with my wife who is rumored to be infertile. And so he definitely gives her this pride of place, one, because she's a head of state and he does respect her intellect, but two, she gave him the son. So I'm like, that is very true to real life, real history. Like, I love you because of your brain and the fact that you gave me a child, not anything else. Yeah, that was impressive that they fit all that in. But if you have a 4-hour production, of course, you can fit the nuance in that maybe a hour and a half can't. And then actually, I quickly want to add in another quick aside. As a very noted musical film score fan, and believe me, I know all the deep histories. I go to every film score, anything. And so I have a deep knowledge. I dare anyone to test me on it. But this gorgeous score was composed by Alex North, who's one of the famous composers of old. He's kind of in the Max Steiner, Alfred Newman sort of era, which was like kind of a golden age because that was when they were first figuring out like orchestral scores and putting things together and being like, oh, so this is what happens when you do this. And so one of the things I love most is I love music, and it's fine if you compose something to an ancient film or whatever that kind of adds to the theme. But like this one explicitly to me sounded like it fit the mood. And I'm always shocked when I find a film score that actually fits the mood of the film it's accompanying. And so what Alex North did here is just downright spectacular. I mean, he was not known for being a very experimental composer, right? He's not like a modern Sarah Schachner, right? So when I think of stuff she's done, she's composed for like Assassin's Creed Origins, and like she went to the trouble of finding ancient instruments or their modern version and like incorporating those instruments in. This era in the 60s was still very much orchestral, like full-on thing. People didn't really start experimenting, honestly, until I want to say like Planet of the Apes with Jerry Goldsmith, when he was like, all right, we're gonna like use some weird shit. But this is a very much more traditional film score, but he still managed to capture the emotions just right. And that's rare in historical films, because I can count on two, maybe even one hand, how many modern films that have come out since 2010 that have a score that sound ancient or capture the mood. And so a film score is something that matters to you as a film watcher, as a moviegoer. This one is a standout for me. So when I talk about films with excellent scores that sort of fit the thing it's going for, Alex North's score here, and I you can find the whole thing on Spotify. I have it in my film score library, and I will just listen to it on a day. And like the minute I hear the score, I know exactly what's happening. I can envision it. It's really atmospheric. It's really lovely. And so I'm just going to throw that in as like something that you know.
The music was really, really great. I really enjoyed that. You're right, it's kind of expansive with that whole orchestral backdrop that I don't think is maybe so common. I enjoy music that goes with movies. It's not something that will necessarily trip me up as I'm listening and watching. But there is something about older movies with not even the volume, just the presence. I feel like there's a huge presence for the music in this film. It was really, really good. I enjoyed it very much.
I could write a whole dissertation on the history of music in film, because God knows I've done the research and I've gone to enough events and seen enough films and stuff. But yeah, no, because I mean, it really evokes, honestly, for sort of the older films, for me, because it was so expansive, it fit the mode of like, yeah, when you have the original King Kong, you're like, it could be a kitschy film, but then you put in Alfred Newman's like score and suddenly it's scary because it's a full-on orchestra. And they really don't do full orchestras, because most, I think, film music people today would agree that it's moved to sort of be more moody and thematic, like tonal almost. They pick themes and then they sort of extrapolate on a main theme. And this is really apparent in some of the newer films. I mean, if you look at something like what Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross did in The Social Network, it's a very thematic thing. You take the main theme and then you extrapolate off of that. But the larger orchestrals, you know, this is more like old school, like Ennio Morricone with like The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And you're just like hit in the face with all enveloping atmospheric orchestral music. So it's amazing. I love it. I could talk about film music forever. So stop me now. Jump in with something.
I wanted to ask what costuming choice was either your most or least favorite on any character.
Okay. Favorite but most inaccurate is the dress that she wore coming in through that lavish procession to Rome, because that's like the most anachronistic scene in the entire movie. I mean, she's wearing this getup, which I was like, that is not, I mean, maybe she would have worn something kind of, but not that. So that was interesting. If anything, I was like, she would have worn the double crown. Like, why is she wearing this like sort of head covering thing with just the Nemes? I was like, I don't understand this, but okay. But I loved it because there's a meme and it's one of my favorites, and it's the picture of her in that costume, and it says, dress for the job you want, not the job you have. And it's her in costume, full costume. And I'm like, yes. So I routinely send that meme to friends and family when I'm having a weird day. And I'm like, here, just laugh at this, because that's my MO. I send people funny historical memes. So I, yeah, that's definitely become a favorite because of that meme. And it goes with that platform that is completely anachronistic, because they did not have a platform that like had a spinny turntable thing that allowed her to like stay flat as they were going downhill. So yeah, that whole getup. Least favorite, I honestly hated that leopard print thing that I think Mark Antony wore, that's like turquoise and leopard print. That was just a mistake. I was like, why? This is, I mean, if they wanted to show how flamboyant he was, well then mission succeeded, but like, that was just bad. What about you?
I think the thing, and we've already talked briefly about the costuming being not accurate, the one thing that was very strange to me was having almost all of the slaves, the male slaves, wearing the Nemes headdress. If you think of the Tutankhamun death mask, for those who are not familiar with Egyptian crowns, not sure why everyone would be familiar, but it's the Tutankhamun funerary mask that you think of. The headdress he's wearing, the striped hat thing, is the Nemes headdress. And it felt like every single slave in ancient Egypt in this movie was wearing one. And I get that it's visually, it's Egyptian. You see someone wearing one of those, you know, we're in Egypt right now. I don't think it was necessary, given the movie is called Cleopatra, to point out to everyone that we are in Egypt. I think most people are aware of that. So having all of these slaves wearing a pharaonic headdress was a strange costuming choice to me. Looked very weird. Generally, I really enjoyed the costumes. It was spectacular and shiny and glittery, and Cleopatra's dresses were extraordinary. Absolutely. And there was a lot of cleavage. Lots of cleavage. Lots of cleavage. So that was fascinating.
I mean, when it's made for a male audience, men
well,
want
quite.
Cleavage.
I mean, you're working with Elizabeth Taylor, so.
Yeah, men want cleavage.
Exactly.
I mean, distracting, but like valid, which is probably why she got all of them to like do her bidding, because they were like, let me just look at that cleavage there and then be lulled into whatever you're selling me. She could have sold the ocean a cup of water.
Very successfully. Mm. And also, another thing that I want to ask someone, I don't know who, I need to find a Roman, an historian of Roman military dress. There were lots of very short man skirts. This is a recurring theme. We had it when we watched Ulysses as well. There were some scandalously short man dresses in that. But I don't know if that's there because people just expected men in very short dresses, or if actually, in ancient Rome, ancient Greece, that was just what men wore when they went out to battle. Because the senators are all in very long togas. They look very regal. Not regal because it's Rome, but, you know, senatorial. There we go. They looked very senatorial. And then all of the army people, all of the soldiers are in short leather, like very short leather kilts. Yeah, I want to know if this is accurate. And if it's not, why the 1960s chose to put, with some regularity, their Roman soldiers in mini dresses. It's an interesting choice.
I don't understand it. I kind of do based on like trends in film. But when I think about actual Roman legions, the costuming that was actually surprisingly good, was in the 2011 The Eagle with Jamie Bell and Channing Tatum, and they had like the pants, the red pants that Roman legionaries would wear. And if you look at the costuming in The Eagle, you'll know what I mean. I don't know, just like look up a picture of Channing Tatum. But like, yes, you have the belt.
If it was women in short skirts, then I'd assume it's a sex male gaze thing. But it's a bunch of dudes in short skirts, so it's probably not a sex thing.
I would understand it more if it were Greek, because the Greeks, yes, like we have evidence and we know that they didn't wear pants. They would have worn like a belted chiton or whatever it's called. But just by the time you get to the Romans, and especially Roman military, I mean, again, I'm not a historian of Rome, so I don't know. We should ask a Roman historian.
Roman historians, if you're listening, please tell us, why are Roman soldiers regularly in miniskirts?
Yeah.
Is this normal? Am I missing something?
I feel like the answer is going to be, it's normal in film. It's not normal in history.
But why?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not complaining. I am a very big fan of men in dresses and skirts. I'm Scottish by blood. I enjoy a good kilt as much as the next woman does. It's a confusing trend for me.
Fascinating. Truly, it's fascinating. Yeah, I would like to know. I would like to know very much.
We should talk about Cleopatra's handmaidens briefly before we finish up. Because I feel like they were very deliberately chosen to be a wide range of ethnicities. Like there's a blonde-haired, presumably blue-eyed girl. There's a black woman. There's a Chinese woman, which was, I assume, totally anachronistic. And yeah, was confused.
I mean, it wouldn't be inconceivable that there were Asians because of, I mean, just cross-cultural interaction. Alexander went all the way into Asia. He didn't go to China, but he went into Asia. So there could have been, but I'm just like, why is she there?
I assumed, my thinking about that was that they were trying to show Cleopatra's, like the reach of her power. Her power isn't just concentrated, her influence isn't just concentrated in just Egypt. She's so powerful, she draws all people, all cultures to Egypt. I didn't know if it was like framing Egypt as this multicultural power.
I mean, I think that's what they were trying to do, but at the same time, it's interesting because, and I just had a great conversation with an expert in Ptolemaic Egypt, so this time period, but she examines cross-cultural interactions with ancient Persia, so obviously tying it in somewhere. But the Seleucids were in power, obviously, but then, yeah, they eventually make way for the Parthians. But at this time, I'm like, the Seleucids still were not playing nice with Rome. And then the Parthians had many notable interactions with Rome. Several of them were wars before then. They did their like cultural exchange thing. So I'm kind of like, if they weren't playing nice and they were kind of at war, that would have made that region, which is where presumably someone would have to come from Asia, an area of conflict. And so I'm kind of like, I don't, but also they want to show her reach and her power. But at the same time, they talk about how she wants Antony to fork over his eastern territories. But also he's preparing to have war with Parthia. So I'm like, assuming that by 31, the Parthians are in power, they're not making nice, so you don't control that region. So I don't understand how they're there. So just putting timelines together, I'm like, that doesn't make sense. Unless she was there beforehand, unless she was part of the slave trade. But again, conflict. And so unless merchants were like smuggling people through conflict areas, maybe. But then she would have had to go through like, but you have to go through like the Middle East. So I'm like, okay, so it's the Parthians are here, and then you have some of the other, I don't know.
I think you and I are probably reading too much.
I'm reading way too much into it because it's a stupid Hollywood thing. And they were probably like, you just need diverse casting. So cast an Asian person. Because see, if I'm a historian and I'm having trouble putting together all the timelines historically, there's no way they've thought this much into it because they're probably like, we don't care.
What will look the best?
Yeah.
What will look the most interesting and
I still take issue with the fact that like it's the Asian one that they were like, let's kill her off, and then you know, and then have her drink the poison.
She can be the traitor.
But you know what? It was kind of just like, that's gross and weird. But in my older years, I've done more research into like that Asian stereotype where, have you ever wondered why it's so important for, well, the rumor is it's so important that an Asian person, when talking to a non-Asian person, look you in the eye when you're speaking? Because there's this weird stereotype that existed way back of, if they don't look you in the eye, they're shifty. And they're shifty because they employ tactics like poison. And so they're like, you have to look people in the eye because you don't want to be shifty. And then so I'm like, this probably is an offshoot. They weren't consciously thinking about it, but I bet, especially in the 60s, especially when people were hostile to Asian people, that made it into Hollywood, where they were like, okay, she's the exotic Asian. And so because poison is a woman's weapon and we need the shifty person, who's the most likely to be the shifty one, let's give it to the Asian. So then they were like, okay, so like, let's have the Asian do it and then try to present her the poison cup. And so it's like patching on to that shifty Asian stereotype, because also I noticed in the movie that she never looked Cleopatra in the eye until she was caught, because she did like the subtle taste and then like wiped the cup. And then she does, she like puts her head down, presents her with the chalice and just goes like, I present this to you. And so to the normal person, it looks like she's just kind of bowing her head, but she's not looking her in the eye.
I thought that was just like a deferential thing, but that's really, really
like interesting. I think it was meant to be deferential, but because of that stereotype existing, and in the 60s, this would have definitely been a thing in the history of America and other places, but especially America. I think that subtly fed its way into it. So I'm sure that they were going like, this is deferential, but in the back of their mind, it probably subconsciously was there. And so I'm like, that's probably why the Asian character is the one who did it, because they're shifty.
Okay.
So, and I learned that because my mom, when she was raising me, was always like, honey, always look people in the eye when you're talking. And I'm like, why? Like, no one cares. And she's like, they care. And that was my introduction to white people.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a habit that has stuck with me, which is why when I talk to people, I look them straight in the eye. And it's like, I don't even realize I do it, because I mean, I'm like, well, I want to show I'm engaged and paying attention. But also apparently it's like that code switching thing where to make them trust you.
Also, yay, racism.
You look them in the eye. So fun fact, that probably made it in, and that's why. But I'm extrapolating there. So maybe if, you know, someone who made the...
It's all interesting. Like, even if it wasn't, like you said, a deliberate choice, it's in the background, it probably will have fed into and influenced the casting choices.
Mm-hmm. And even if you're not like an Asian person, and if you were not aware of this stereotype, some people are. But like, as an Asian person watching this, I can probably say that Asians watching this would be the first to recognize like that it subtly kind of confirms that bad stereotype, even if other people don't realize what's happening. Movies in the 60s.
Things you don't even realize.
Yeah, well.
Because as a white person, it's not something that I'm going to have come across, at least not consciously.
No, I mean, you got to be part of the great British Empire that kind of colonized the world.
Yay!
On the top of the pyramid. So, oh, that lovely privilege, man. No, this movie is so layered, like in so many different ways.
Yeah.
So we're
about at an hour, so we should wrap up now. But please come back and join us next week. We'll be talking to Dr. Kara Cooney. We have a whole list of questions to ask her. We've already asked you some of them. So if you know the answers, please share with us, specifically about Roman kilts. Very interested in that. And yeah, we'll be going over some of the more historical details. And Dr. Cooney is a bit of an expert on female rulers in Egypt. She published a book recently on the subject. So she is definitely the person we want to be asking about Cleopatra. But thank you for joining us. We'll see you next week.
Oh, yeah. All right, guys. Bye.
Bye.
Hey, thanks for listening. Don't forget to leave us a review. And you can also follow us on social media at The Reading Party Podcast. If you'd like to leave us a book or movie suggestion, then email us at thereadingpartypod@gmail.com. See you next week.